Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause. OneCause is the creator of user-friendly fundraising software that helps nonprofits engage donors, raise more money, and save valuable time and resources. At OneCause, we know that Giving Days can galvanize your donor base, amplify donations, and attract new supporters, which is why we published a step-by-step how-to guide to help both the novice and experienced fundraiser get the most out of your next Giving Day. To download your copy of the OneCause Giving Day Guide, please visit www.onecause.com/responsive40. That's www.onecause.com/responsive40. Hi, podcast listeners. I want to thank you for joining us for today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Today, my guest is Ian McQuillan. Ian and I have enjoyed bantering on the Rogeri website for probably a couple of years now. You and I, Ian, met at the Canterbury event that Beth Breeze was hosting. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that.
Yes. I remember you and I meeting. It was a very, very quaint little event, and I enjoyed really in meeting you and some others. And I think the last time you and I saw each other, Ian, was at AFP Icon in New Orleans when I was getting my book out there. But that's enough about when you and I met. Why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah. So hi, everyone, and thanks very much for having me on this, Jason. My name is Ian McQuillan. I'm the director of the fundraising think tank Rogeri. Rogeri is Latin for to ask. So all the best think tanks have Latin or Greek names, don't they? So we've gone for the Latin one. And you can easily remember how to pronounce it. It's like Volare. So whenever you think of Rogeri now, you'll just think of whoa, 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 whoa at the end of it. And this has been set up. I've been doing Rogeri now for what's coming up for about 6 years, and I've had a long career in the fundraising profession, even though I'm not a fundraiser. I was a journalist to start with, and I used to edit a magazine in the UK. And when I moved into fundraising, I'd moved from a different sector altogether. I was editing a magazine in the waste management industry, and a lot of the conferences there, a lot of the thinking was all very focused on environmental ethics, on new thinking, new ways of doing stuff. And I was kind of very aware that a lot of that was missing in fundraising when I moved in to start editing a magazine here. And what I did a lot of the times while I was working on what was then called professional fundraising was to bring in a lot of those kind of articles where we were trying to explore those things. And I kind of realized that I had in the back of my mind that we needed to have a think tank that was trying to bring this critical reflection and to bring some ideas that have been developed in different parts of the academy. So in social psychology, in moral philosophy, and get those ideas embedded into professional practice. And about 6 years ago, I owe a massive debt of gratitude to Adrian Sargent and Jen Shang, because I was telling them about I had this idea to run this think tank, and they created a job for me at Plymouth University. So 6 years ago, I set up Rogeri at Plymouth with Adrian and Jen. Unfortunately, Plymouth decided they no longer wanted our services a couple of years ago, so now I'm running it as an independent organization. But that's how we got to where we are with Rogeri.
Okay, so I have to ask, what lessons did you carry with you from the waste management industry into fundraising? That's fascinating. I don't know that I've heard that particularly.
Well, I brought in there. So you won't know this, but when I was editing a professional fundraising magazine, people knew me as a critical friend of fundraising, that I would stand up for fundraising against people that were attacking it in the media, from regulators, from government, for things like that. But they would also know that when I criticized it, that they probably should listen because I was a critical friend. And I'd learnt to do that on the waste management sector. So the kind of things that people saw me doing on professional fundraising and that how we do with Regari now, I'd brought some of those things to me, to this sector from waste management. But apart from that, you know, journalism is a skill that you take from, a portfolio skill you take from calls to calls, from job to job, pretty much like fundraising is.
Yes, yes, that's fascinating. That's totally fascinating. I could simmer on that. We could go on a tangent about that, but we won't. So, Ian,
I was trying to tempt you there.
So, Ian, when we when I invite a guest on the podcast, as you well know, we generally talk about a really big idea, and I'm interested in what that idea might be for you and I today.
So, the thing that interests me most of all is professional ethics in fundraising, because so much follows from that. And a lot of the work we do at Regari is around fundraising's professional ethics, because it's so surprising how little work has actually been done on this over the past 20 to 30 years. If you go and look at books on marketing ethics, and which is probably marketing and public relations are fundraising's closest cousins from when you're looking about a discipline and body of work, there's so much that's written about that. I've got one book on marketing ethics that's got 90 chapters in it. It's a reprint of 90 different papers. And that's just the papers that the editors thought were the best ones. That doesn't exhaust the topic at all. But everything that's ever written on fundraising ethics barely comes to half of that. There's probably about 45 various papers that have been written about fundraising ethics. And so that's the kind of thing I think is really missing, that kind of underpins professional practice. So I'm not saying for any, I don't want anyone to hear this and think I'm saying fundraising is unethical. It isn't unethical at all. It's perfectly ethical. Fundraising is inherently ethical thing to be doing. But a lot of the theories and the tools and the toolkits we need to be able to make sure we do that consistently and coherently just haven't been done. And a lot of the questions that we face in fundraising, the ethical questions, come back to to I think this fundamental problem that we don't have a sound theory of ethics that underpins it. And that takes us into things such as what fundraising methods we should use, whether we should employ guilt or not, and if so, in which circumstances, how we frame beneficiaries in fundraising materials. And it takes us into questions about who we ask and when we ask them. So if I can, I'll just say a little bit about, that's the big picture, but yeah, I know you want to talk about donor-centered fundraising. And I think some people think I'm not a fan of donor-centered fundraising, that I'm a critic of it. But that's not the case at all. If I were a fundraiser, which I'm not, but if I were, I would do donor-centered fundraising. It works. It works well. It ticks all the buttons on human psychology, why people would want to give. And if you can do fundraising in such a way that it raises loads of money for your beneficiaries and it makes your donors happy, you've got this win-win situation going on there. So, of course, you would do that. But, you know, nothing's perfect. This is a form of fundraising as an idea we've had now for coming on to 30 years. It has to develop, because if it didn't have to develop, it would have been perfect from day one and nothing would have been problematic with it. And of course, there have to be issues with it. So what I'm doing is I'm just trying to critique some of the things that we don't do well, or we don't know why they work, or we could do better. And there are questions about, you know, there are possibly some harms that can be caused by fundraising in this way. And it's beholden upon us as ethical professionals to look at where those harms might be.
I have to say, Ian, though, and it's really you. I got to give you credit for this. So I think it was this whole notion of the beneficiary and the, give me the official title of that one particular piece that you guys have.
It's called rights balancing fundraising ethics. So what this says is that fundraising is ethical when fundraisers can correctly balance their duties to their donors and their beneficiaries, so that both groups you get an optimal outcome for both groups while significantly harming neither of them. So the work on ethics that's been done in the past has really put most of the focus on the donor and what you do that's right for the donor. Now, in doing things that are right for the donor, it is possible not you know, by any means certain, but it's possible that you could cause harm to beneficiaries. And there's an example of that from the UK. You can put British fundraisers into a dead faint, like those mountain goats or those goats that just fall over when they faint, just by whispering the words GDPR in their ears, and you know they start frothing at the mouth. So a couple of years ago, people were saying you had to get donors' consent before you contacted them via direct mail.
Right.
Not email, not phone, which requires a different set of rules, and you have to get their consent. But the reason for doing that was because it was the right thing to do for donors. You were prioritizing the donor's interest. But of course, we all know what happens there. Lots of people didn't give consent through inertia, through laziness. And fundraisers lost a lot of donors, charities lost a lot of money, and that definitely wasn't in their beneficiaries' interest to have lost that amount of money that could have provided services for them.
See, I think it was when you put that stuff out, and when that was about a year, maybe 18 months ago, and I started thinking about, okay, is there ever a time when let's sort of recognize that there certainly can be instances where the beneficiary and the donor's rights, which is the word you choose to use, where what is in their best interest can actually be at odds. And I don't know that I would be an advocate for ever a time when the donor needs to be more central to those decisions than the beneficiary. And so I think it was actually because I had never, so I come from the sort of the faith-based space. So most of the organizations that I've historically worked with were these faith-based organizations, and they always put faith at the center of things, right? So if you're a Christian organization, they would always say that they were Christ-centered organizations. So these organizations would never have said, and some of them were quite blatant about this, they would never put the donor at the center of anything. And now that I've sort of, you know, some of my clients are not necessarily in that space anymore, Ian, but then you come along with this notion of sort of where do we position the beneficiary? And I don't know that the beneficiary should ever be anywhere other than at the center of what we're doing. And therefore it kind of puts the donor, I mean, I'm sorry, you got me really thinking about this, and I have to say, I mean, I diligently read through that. It's been 18 months, but you really got me thinking there.
Well, the beneficiary has to be at the center of what the whole charity or the whole nonprofit does.
Yeah.
That's why they exist. That's why they are there.
Sure.
So the reason charities exist is to help the beneficiary or the contributor group or the service user or whatever.
Yeah.
So what donors do is they make that possible. Without donors, you couldn't help the person that you do. So it looks like you're serving two constituencies. You're serving beneficiaries on one side and you're serving donors on the other side. But I think what happens is that because fundraising is seen as the necessary evil and it gets marginalized from the rest of the organization, that you get this schism in charities, whereas instead of it looking like everybody is focused on serving the beneficiary needs, fundraising gets slightly hived off as being slightly separate, slightly out of phase to the rest of the organization. And they're outward looking from away from the beneficiary to the donor. So I think you slightly get that kind of schism that happens there. And a lot of professional practice in fundraising has built its core identity around that you are like the agent of the donor. It is your job to serve the donor's interests. Now, as I said, and I repeatedly say, I'm not a fundraiser.
Yeah.
But if I were a fundraiser and somebody asked me why I did it, I would say, well, I'm a fundraiser because I want to make sure charities have enough resources to help these people. But I think if you'll ask a lot of fundraisers why they're fundraisers, they say, I want to connect a donor to a cause. And that is a completely different focus that you're focusing on. First of all, one focuses on the needs of the beneficiary.
Yeah.
And then the way you fundraise becomes an end to a means to that end. But when you say I'm focused on the needs of the donor, the needs of the donor could become an end in its own right.
Okay. So when you put, okay. So, and I've got to pick on a little. So you constantly remind us that you're not a fundraiser, but I am a fundraiser. I spent two decades fundraising, and I spent most of my career like doing donor facing work. And with the exception of any time that I might have been sitting across the table from an arrogant jerk, for example, there was never a donor that I can think of that would have ever wanted me to suggest that I was doing donor-centered fundraising. They always would have wanted me to do exactly what you're saying we should, you know, what you're suggesting, that the idea that we put the beneficiary at the middle of it. They don't want to be in the middle of this. And part of what concerns me about the way that fundraising gets done, and this was also some of the stuff that I started to pick up while I was in the UK briefly, was this idea that the people who are the least, who are the most sort of distanced or removed from the actual donor, largely because of these arm's length practices, are also the ones that that sort of inherently assume that donor-centered fundraising is a good thing. But these are also the people that whose fundraising practices don't put them in front of the donor very closely. They're not engaging with donors in any meaningful way to therefore be told, hey, I don't want to be at the middle of what you're doing. Does that make sense?
It does. But then I would say that what people say they want and what they actually want are not necessarily the same things. And you often hear people will be talking about it and they're saying, a charity wasted money. It didn't need to thank me. I got a letter saying thank you. And what a waste of money. They should have spent it on something else.
Yeah.
But if you didn't thank them, they'd have probably been complaining that they weren't thanked because they gave them some money. So you kind of often find yourself in this win-less situation. So what I said about means and ends, if you think that donor-centered fundraising is a means to the end of raising more money to help beneficiaries, then it's purely an instrumental thing. It's a tool. The donor doesn't have to want to be at the center of what of what charities do or what fundraisers do.
Yeah.
You don't have to go and say you are at the center of what we do. But if you use all the methods and the techniques that Adrian Sargent and Jen Chang are developing, and the kind of copy that Tom Ahern writes, where you say, because of you, we did this and you made this happy, and that person gets a buzz and their sense of moral identity is get up and that increases and they get a serotonin rush. That seems to me to be the right thing to be doing. That seems to work very, very well. There's the social psychology that explains to you why it works. If you then go and ask them, do you want to be at the center of what we do? They're going to say, oh, no, of course I don't want to be that. But at the same time, people like getting presents, and serotonin is a nice present to get.
So there's actually an author. He's in the United Kingdom. I can't recall his name. He actually owns a consulting firm. And part of what – and I've been reading his stuff. And part of what his critique on – he's actually talking to the customer, this sort of this customer-centric world, right? This world that says that the customer, which is sort of the – and I'm sort of drawing the assumption that some of our language is and our theories is being drawn from the for-profit sector and this customer centrism and stuff. And what his argument is, and I've sort of restructured the phrase and used it myself. I think I've even used it in my conversations with you, is this notion that donor-centered fundraising is just simply an organizational view of the donor. And that if the donor actually defined, and he would be saying the customer, that if the donor actually defined the definition of what putting them at the center was, and therefore that definition was in their control. If we actually ask the donor, okay, what do you want this relationship to look like? Which is to say that we let them be the center of it, that we would have to relinquish control of it. And so what he's arguing is that donor-centered or customer-centered is really just an organizational sort of control freak thing going on that feels good. And it sort of loops back to what you just said, Ian, a few moments ago, like to suggest that the donor would doesn't always necessarily say what they actually mean. I think we've got a lot of fundraisers running around saying donor-centrism, right? Mm-hmm. That I am a donor-centered fundraising. But in fact, if we actually handed control of the relationship over to the donor, I don't think they'd be as donor-centered anymore.
Yeah, well, I think there's two things there. First one is what you mean by donor-centered. It's one of those things that is fairly nebulous and isn't totally defined.
Yeah,
we have an idea of what we mean by it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a communications practice. It's a way of controlling, you know, giving people control. It's also an ethical idea that, you know, the right thing to do is to put the donor in control of what they do. So there's, you can, it can mean to an extent all things to all people.
Yeah.
So one of one of those is that kind of is a definitional issue. But you also said about borrowing ideas from consumer theory and consumer behavior and commerce.
Yeah.
And you can't just take ideas of custom centricity and start translating them into fundraising and nonprofit marketing because donors are not consumers and donation is not the same process as consumption. So if you're a consumer, you give a company via a marketer some money and they give you a service in return. If you're a donor, you give a charity some money and they provide a service or good for somebody else entirely, and that's the beneficiary. So whereas consumption is an exchange and the marketer's role in that is to is the mediator of that exchange, charity donation is a transfer process and the fundraiser mediates the transfer. And that is why you can be customer-centric, because everything literally, not literally, obviously not metaphorically, does revolve around the customer. But because there is a transfer process, you're trying to find a way to get both donor and the beneficiary at the center of that process. And it involves a lot of dissonance for people as they're thinking about that. So I just don't think you can take ideas of customer centricity and start applying them to donors, to the charity sector, because you've got to think, who is the customer of the charity's services? The customer of their service is the beneficiary.
But Ian, you've got to be fair with me here. If I went down and I pulled out books, I can't think of her name. It's sort of, even your friend, and I have not, the gentleman you co-worked with Adrian borrows everything from marketing. I don't know how you can, I don't know how we can,
No, you can borrow and you can adapt. So what Adrian does, and you know, the best, Regari is all about borrowing ideas. I didn't invent my ideas about fundraising ethics. You know, I didn't have to go back and reinvent the wheel, the wheel. Lots of this has been done.
Yeah.
What we have to do is we have to take ideas from other disciplines, from other sectors, and we have to apply them and adapt them to fundraising and to charity marketing. What we can't do is take something that's meant to regulate and facilitate a market exchange and think this will work in fundraising, where it's not a market exchange, it's a transfer between donors who've got resources and beneficiaries that don't.
Okay.
That's what I mean by that, is that when we see ideas that they, this is all about being customer-centric, we should do that in charities. Well, who's your customer?
So if we
it's not back, so obvious who the customer is.
So if we went back to where you started, because I think this is where you and I and everybody who's involved with Rogeri would agree, is that fundraising sort of finds itself in this, we don't have the bandwidth. The question of ethics, right? We just don't have the margin or the bandwidth with what we're doing to, guys like you and me are sort of piecing together this margin on our lives in order to sort of deliver some of this critical thinking to the world. And maybe that's what the challenge is to get to what it is you started this off with, is ethics, is that, we've got to sort of flip the switch on fundraising for a little while and say, okay, we're going to stop letting this thing advance. We're going to stop letting this thing continue to evolve until we define the ethics of it. Because I think that's what's so problematic about fundraisers at the beginning of their career, just like what you're trying to achieve with ethics, is that you can't, you don't have time to breathe. You don't have time to contemplate. You know, if we were talking about the profession at a sort of big macro level, as if it was one individual sort of sitting in an armchair trying to sort of contemplate some of these things, he or she is so desperate to achieve their fundraising goals next month that they don't have the time to do that.
Oh, absolutely. When you said the bandwidth there and the time, I mean, I think that's absolutely key to this. And you also mentioned, you said the profession, and it is a moot point whether fundraising really is a profession or not.
Yeah.
At which point, you know, I said I try and say things that are probably not controversial, and probably people are lobbing things at their computers as having said that it's not necessarily a profession. But the scholarship that has been done on this, the research that has been done, has withheld judgment about whether fundraising is a profession, because one of the ways to assess whether something, candidate, trade, job, occupation is a profession, is to measure it against a set of necessary and sufficient criteria, like does it have a code of standards, is it self-regulated? communicating, all of those things. And on those things, fundraising falls short on a lot of them. And one of the things that it falls short on is having a body of knowledge that you have to acquire before you are competent to practice.
Yeah.
So fundraising is one of the few professions where you can, or I mean, what they refer to it as, they talk about it as being an emerging profession. Uh-huh. So it's one of the few professions, emerging professions, where you can start on day one knowing nothing about the job that you're doing, but you're free to practice. Most of the other professions, when you come into them, you'll either learnt it before you go in, or you'll be on a concerted, structured learning program while you're there, before you are signed off to practice. But not only can you start fundraising knowing nothing about it, and no point are you required to ever learn anything about it. You just pick it up, you go along. So Beth Fries wrote a book, which you'll know about, The New Fundraisers, yeah. And she published that a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And in that, she spoke to a lot of fundraisers, and a lot of them said that fundraising is caught and not taught. And a lot of she has a great quote in that book where a lot of people were kind of like saying, well, I've never taken a course on fundraising. I've never read a book on it. And they were kind of boasting about the fact that they were fundraisers, but they'd never learned anything about it. They never bothered reading about it. So as you say, that the bandwidth is there. If people are coming in, thrown into the job, having to get on and do the job, they're focused on their targets, the things they've got to do, you know, the strategy, the case for support. They don't have time to sit around and think about, you know, they're thinking about, can I do this? Not whether ought I do it or not. And I don't know what we do about this. I don't know how we liberate the time to spend more time and have more bandwidth focusing on this. But as regards ethics, you know, there's the standard number of ethics sessions per conference is about one. We could spend more time talking about ethics and about these big issues in our formal learning environments a bit more.
You know, I have to say, so I'm doing a presentation at Case in Baltimore here in about 2 weeks, and I'm going to be talking about this. So after my book came out 2 years ago, one of the things I started to notice is that the person that was oftentimes reading my book was about 10 years into their career. So they were generally younger than I initially assumed they might be. And they also were not in decision-making roles. So they were usually in like a number three spot. And I've started to sort of get to know this particular fundraiser. So imagine the person who's already gotten their initial credentials here in the U.S. It's the CFRE. They're about 10 years in. They're not in a decision-making role, but they're starting to think critically about what it is they're doing. And they're also more positive about fundraising as their professional identity than maybe I would have been 25 years ago when I got into this. And I think the collective bandwidth that you and I are sort of talking about, I think these are the people, and you may know some of, I suspect you know some of these in the UK as well. These are people who have the bandwidth sort of in their head professionally, where they're finding the space to think critically about this. I can think of some examples in the UK. You guys have them. I think there's people who are not our age, who are sort of this youngest generation who, like I said, are about 10 years in, who are finding the margin to think critically about this. And I think Rogeri is a great example of where they're going to gravitate towards. I think that's actually what people our age and older need to be thinking about, is that they're not resonating with this, what I call a fundraising positive individual, who wants to think critically about what it is they're doing, who wants to sort of get down on the wrestling mat, Can you envision these people? Do you know, you have to see these people
absolutely.
At the conferences?
I mean, there are plenty of, you know, really fantastic critical thinkers in fundraising. And I could name a couple, but I won't name them.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of two names in America at the moment who are fantastic, but I won't name them just in case I don't name somebody else that I should have done.
I'm sure they're mutual friends. So yes.
but I think what it is, at the moment, they're kind of isolated individual nodes, and there's no real way that connects all of that thinking together.
Yes.
And there's kind of a fundraising orthodoxy. And this is the problem with, you know, when you have orthodoxies, that the heterodox views don't really find a way in. And it's, and I think the thing about with fundraising as well, that you have no learning that you do when you get into fundraising. So people are scrabbling around to actually get all the knowledge that they actually need to function competently as professionals, whereas within a lot of professions, they would already have this.
Yeah.
And so there aren't those networks that they can join where they're actually, I've got a base level of competence. Now I want to know whether I ought to do things, whether I can learn more about stuff. So I think, you know, I think the future looks good for the profession, but I think it's a way of maybe formalizing some of those structures more. So, I mean, one of the things that Simone Joyeau does is they Rebels and Renegades session at the at ICON. I mean, that's a really good format for having more of these critical discussions. And as Simone likes to say, ask some cage rattling questions. But on the other side of that, I kind of have a feeling that sometimes fundraising is a bit like the Lego movie. And you know that scene where it starts with everything is awesome, everything's great, everything's brilliant, everything's going along tickety-boo. And as soon as somebody comes along and says, well, have you thought about that? Are you sure that's as good as you thought you were? You switch movies into the life of Brian. And it's that bit where he said, like, I just had a lovely bit of halibut and said he was good enough for Jehovah. And it's like, blasphemer, stone him. And there's a bit of that kind of sectarian defense does go on, that if you start criticizing, or critiquing is a better word, something as a core to the what of fundraisers believe, then they can get defensive about it. And I think that's one of the things that we need to open up about, is that if you're critically reflecting on stuff, you have to critically reflect about everything, not just the stuff that you don't agree with, but be prepared to have the stuff that you do think is right critically reflected upon by other people and listen to that.
Yes, and that would be my critique. So I was, I think I've been around ICON enough to see the Rebels and Renegades sort of thing, but it seems my critique on that particular it seems sort of a, I can't think of the right expression, and it's probably, it may not be an expression that works for you guys over there, but it seems sort of just to be a sort of a toss about, okay, we'll be controversial about a couple of these things. But I can tell you, just knowing you as well as I do, and we're not the best of friends, but I think we know each other enough. If they put you and me on a session like that, we're going to stir up so much stuff, and we're going to end up going off on so many tangents, I'll ensure of it, that I don't think an institution of that size and that magnitude, and this is where you're getting at with this notion of orthodoxy, they're not going to put up with it, Ian. And I think that's where, but to loop back to ethics and to loop back to this person who's 10 years in, those 10-year veterans that I'm talking about, they don't go to AFP ICON. These are the same, these people are the same people that are telling me I can't afford $800, you know, so very practically speaking, they're not in decision-making roles, and they're finding other venues, places like this podcast, for example, to find that community. And I think that's sort of the reality we live in. And so how we're going to formulate these, you know, I think it's the temptation for a group like yours, for Rogeri, to think, okay, do we form a conference, or does the conference actually get in the way?
It's something that we are actually considering and looking at this. I mean, but it wouldn't be I don't think it would be a conference. I mean, I think we're looking at different ways to think and different ways to gather.
Yeah.
So we are putting together a team to look about how we can do that and how we can build more of a network.
Yeah.
But the one thing that we don't want to do, we don't want to replace one orthodoxy with another.
Right.
So the point about this, you and I, we disagree all the time on the Critical Fundraising Forum. And if anyone's listening to this and doesn't know the Critical Fundraising Forum, it's on Facebook. Please find it and please join. We have lots of discussions in that. You know, you and I disagree lots of over all of that, but the way we advance as individuals and as professionals is by having our ideas challenged.
Yes, sir.
Just because you have your ideas challenged is nothing personal in that. I mean, I don't take anything, any criticism you say of me personally,
right?
And I don't take any of this criticism about my ideas personally at all.
Yeah,
because it isn't personal. It's not about the way I look or the way I sound or, you know, stuff like that. It's about something I choose to believe. And if I haven't got good enough reasons for believing what I do, it's fair game that someone comes along and says to me, your ideas aren't thought through that well. And I live in a constant state of dread that because I'm often putting these ideas out there that I've said something horrendously stupid that one day someone's just going to point out to me, I'm going to look like a complete idiot.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's going to mess with you. I think you're perfectly fine. And I really do appreciate having met you a couple of years ago, Ian. I've had your time for more than a half hour. I think about this, it's not silly, but never mind. I'm not going to go there. But Ian, if somebody's listening to our conversation today and they know how to find me, they know how to find my podcast, but they're saying, how do I find Ian? How do I find the Ruggieri website? How would you suggest that they do that?
So Ruggieri website is ruggieri.net. It's easy to find. But if you put in Ruggieri, we're about the only thing that comes up. There's a Dutch firm called Ruggieri, but they got in and got the net, got ruggieri.com first. So, you know, sod 'em. But they don't really do much. And if you want to find us on Twitter, it's at Ruggieri FTT, Foxtrot Tango Tango, or Fundraising Think Tank, which would have been a better thing to say to get the initials across. So Ruggieri FTT on Twitter. But as I said, the Critical Fundraising Forum, this is our window to the world. This is where we have a lot of these debates and questions. And it's a space where we want people to come along and discuss ideas, throw ideas around. And it's not my place to post my ideas. It's the profession's place for space for it to be discussing and critically reflecting on issues that are important to us.
It's been a pleasure to have you, Ian.
You're always
welcome back. Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.